Good afternoon, and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This is a program that it's an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through generous underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, nearly 40,000 people in the United States die from suicide annually, accounting for one person every 13 minutes. This exceeds the rates of death from homicide and AIDS combined. Currently, more people die by suicide than from automobile accidents, and half of these deaths occur through the use of a firearm. Over the past decade, the suicide rate has been rising. And while much of this increase has been driven by suicides in midlife, suicide is also taking a major toll on young people. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people between 10 and 14. The 2015 Youth Risk Behavior Survey revealed alarming statistics, saying 17% of youth seriously considered suicide in previous year, and more than 14% had made a suicide plan. Today, my guests are going to shine the light on a growing concern affecting our nation and our next generation. My guests are Amy Waddle, Tima's Health School, High School Program Trainer, Frank Warren, Division Manager of Prevention and Outreach at San Luis Obispo County Behavioral Health, and Christine Claxton, volunteer with American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Today's show is live, and we invite you to also join our conversation with your comments, your story, and your questions by calling us at 781-3875, again, 805-781. 3875. And I welcome all three of you today. And this is such a difficult topic. I think it's such an important topic and certainly a heart-wrenching topic as well. So it's with gratitude that I've got all three of you here. And I think probably the first thing is, you know, what role you have in today's discussion. And Frank, I'll start with you.
Okay, yeah, I'm really very happy to be here and honored to be sitting with, you know, Amy and Christine, who have done such great work in our community, and especially in this past year. We've really taken on this very forward approach to suicide prevention. Mm-hmm. It's something that we've talked about in the county for years. There's always been some element of suicide discussion and prevention.
Right.
Really, though, what we're starting to see is people start to figure out exactly how to have those difficult conversations in different manners and in different ways. So my role with the county and the Behavioral Health Department really is two. I have the Prevention and Outreach Division, in which, for instance, we have taken programs like Friday Night Live, which is a traditional alcohol drug prevention program for middle school and high schools, which we're in every public middle and high school, and expanded that role to also address mental wellness, health and wellness,
right,
which includes discussions of suicide mm-hmm. and suicide prevention and postventions with schools, things like that. And then my other hat is I'm the coordinator of what's called the Mental Health Services Act. The Mental Health Services Act is a fund, a large fund that comes to every county in California to expand its own mental health services, whether that's serving difficult to serve populations like veterans or the LGBTQ population who have higher risk for certain areas but are not as not as always given access to treatment. So that's what the Mental Health Services Act comes in and does. So naturally, the Mental Health Services Act pays a lot of attention to suicide prevention. They tried doing so in a very statewide manner, right? We have these statewide initiatives that we take part in as well.
Right.
But really what it comes down to is how does your local community have the conversation? And so we, in our Mental Health Services Act role, do a lot of support for our local suicide prevention council. We're about to develop a suicide prevention coordinator position. So somebody who to help tie all these things you're going to hear about today together, including, you know, the county's, you know, work as well. So I really have a great role in that I'm both a cheerleader for the great work, you know, being done and hopefully help find funding for those things. But I also have a staff, you know, who actually are out working with veterans, homeless, LGBTQ youth, as well as adults, and then all of our school system to try to make these improvements, you know, where we can. You know, and on a personal note, you know, it wasn't until probably the third person I lost to suicide did I recognize that you know, this was the field I was in,
because you
can become somewhat detached to it. So I'm honored to be with survivors. I'm honored to be with family members today to so that we can continue this discussion. So thanks.
That's great. Thank you. And Christine, I'm going to go to you next.
Sure. So how I became involved with suicide prevention is I'm a lost survivor. I lost my son 5 years ago to suicide. He was 20 years old. He struggled with mental illness and just he couldn't see another way out, and his choice was to go die by suicide. So from that point, it's taken me this long, 5 years, to be able to find the courage and the strength to actually talk about it. And the more I talk about it, the more I see the need that it needs to be discussed.
Yeah.
And that it needs to be in the forefront in our schools and in conversations in community groups, all of it. We need to get the word out there. So through that, I started working with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And this past year, I chaired the Out of the Darkness Walk, which was a huge success of a walk, but a huge healing time for myself and for the community to have 400 people come together who have like-minded experiences. Just cry, laugh, hold each other. It's an awesome experience. So it was a wonderful weekend.
And that event has grown in participation a lot
in
the years that I've watched it, from, you know, just a handful of people showing up who already had reached a place of comfort, if
right.
you will, if there is a place of comfort, to be able to show up and say, I'm here and I want to reach out to
yes.
people that are still very raw.
Definitely. And we had a lot of volunteers who couldn't bring themselves to actually walk,
right.
but they wanted to help. So they were setting up tables and doing everything they could do within their means.
Right.
And then I got several emails just this past week saying, I can't wait to walk next year. I'm ready to do it. And it's like, this is what it's all about, the healing part. So that's wonderful.
Yeah. And Amy, I'm going to go to you next.
Well, the first role that I play in all of this is as a survivor myself. I've had mental illness the majority of my life, and it really robbed me of my voice for many, many years. And so for me to be able to speak like I do and be here today, honestly, is just a complete miracle. and, you know, being a survivor of suicide and knowing so many people close to me who have struggled, I just feel really passionate about starting those conversations, because not everybody's comfortable with that scary word. You know, and so for us, we say it every day in our work, but a lot of people don't. So for us to be open about it and transparent and not be afraid to bring up those difficult things, I think it takes a lot of courage for Christine to be here. And being part of the walk last weekend and having my daughter up there with me was really a moving experience. My mental health condition really tried to steal my life from me, and the darkest time that I experienced deep into my suicidal ideation, my daughter was 3 years old, and I remember so many moments that I was saying to myself, I can't die because she needs a mom. Mm-hmm. And so for her to be up there with me was just a healing experience, knowing that she is now a little mental health advocate. in her school, and she knows what brain health is, so that's really exciting. I'm also, now that I have found my voice and have really adopted the role as mental health advocate, I do youth mental health first aid trainings for school staff, particularly high school staff. And that is a action plan that teachers can implement if they suspect a student is struggling with their mental health condition, how to approach the student, how to give them reassurance and hope, and then what to say and how to get them help. And I love teaching. I love teaching youth mental health first aid and seeing those light bulbs go on in people's minds. And also to teach them from a perspective of, I was a youth with a mental health condition no one knew about. Okay, so I kind of have this inside look at, you know, it's actually okay to say something because they really want you to know, but they don't want to have to tell you. Another thing that I've been certified in is called QPR. QPR is a three-step suicide prevention action plan. And it stands for question, persuade, refer. Mm-hmm. It is a training we've done for the high school, San Luis Obispo High. All of the staff are now trained in QPR and also their leadership students. And it's now growing to Templeton High School. And the students are really excited to be able to be there for each other. You'd think that they would be like, no, we don't want to talk about that, but they do want to talk about that. So, and connecting with them and saying, you know what, I've been there, I know, and it's hard, and it's okay to say, I'm not okay. Really, just giving them that permission.
Thank you. Well, and you said you were talking about two words that are kind of often not coming out, mental illness and suicide. Yeah. Yeah. And Frank, the programs in the schools that Amy was talking mm-hmm. about, what kind of value does that have to the schools, and how are the schools reacting to that?
Fantastic. And I think the most important thing is with a school is understanding that they exist as little islands, you know, and what happens at one district doesn't necessarily work at another. What happens at one campus doesn't necessarily work at another. What we found at San Luis High, and I think one of the reasons why I think Amy is having such a good response there, is they started to recognize for themselves that the culture on campus, while being supportive and very forward thinking, they've had, you know, that campus has had counselors, contracted counselors on campus mm-hmm. for issues for years. Yeah. They've always been a forward thinking district, but the conversation mm-hmm. about suicide is different. Mm-hmm. The approach.
How is it different?
Well, as Amy was describing, there are methods to understand where a person is at that moment. There are methods to understand that this may be different than a psychotic break, right? Which a lot of times in the conversation it gets lumped together, but they're not necessarily the same thing. A suicidal ideation can happen without a mental illness. Suicidal ideation can happen without a long history of crisis or a long history of struggles. Mm-hmm. And so understanding that the person, I think Amy used the term, you didn't say functioning, a hidden you know, mental illness is very real, and that goes for suicidal thoughts as well. Sometimes it can catch a person off guard, and if it catches a person too off guard, damage can be done, you know, in how they respond. You've heard the conversation in the public before about never, like, you know, challenging a person who's saying that they're suicidal at the moment. Those types of things aren't meant out of malice as much as they become our natural reaction sometimes to how people present information. To have a person tell you that they are thinking of taking their own life is quite a challenge. You have to be prepared in a different way than you are for a person who says, I don't feel well, mm-hmm. I feel blue, I feel dark, I feel, even if they feel dangerous to themselves, it doesn't always mean suicide, right?
Right.
So having that conversation on a school campus is so valuable, because that's where our young people spend our day. You actually said that at the suicide prevention forum. I heard myself saying, I was like, wait, somebody just reminded me that it is such an important point. Amy brought this up at the suicide prevention forum that, you know, why aren't we having that discussion in the time where, you know, most adolescents are spending the most time.
Right.
So what we're seeing with You know, we did a pilot program at Atascadero High a few years ago, which was really built around the same type of take advantage of a school that wants to have the dialogue.
Yeah.
And that dialogue was around mental health and wellness. Mm-hmm. And you use the term brain health, Amy. It's that type of approach that goes alongside of academic, you know, success and social, you know, ability and all those things, too. What we found when we did so is the same thing with, we have a middle school program where we have counselors in six different middle schools who look for early signs of risk, but most of that risk is related to what we would term, you know, mental health issues mm-hmm. or substance use issues. What we found is a lot of those young people we were screening were also suicidal or had at least the beginnings of thoughts about suicidal. I'm not talking self-harm. I'm not talking about, that happens as well, but I'm talking truly, you know, suicidal. So our approach these last 5 years, really 5 to 10 years, has been to try to get to schools and try to help them find a way that they can respond with training or policy or protocol, really important, to be able to respond on campus. So seeing Transitions Mental Health Association, who you referred to,
as TEMA,
who builds this, you know, they've gone out and got some grant funding in order to be present on a campus like that. We need to do build that all in every district. And so that's what we're working on.
I'm going to take a real quick break and reintroduce, but I want to come back and I want to talk about some of what, let's start with what parents can look for at home in terms of signs and symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then I want to talk about at school too and how we can kind of mesh those too. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Supported Radio for the Central Coast from Monterey to Ventura County. If you just joined us, today's show is about teen suicide, a growing concern for parents and our country. My guests are Amy Waddle from TEMA's high school program. She's a TEMA high school program trainer. Frank Warren, division manager of prevention and outreach at SLO County Behavioral Health. And Christine Claxton, a volunteer with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. You can be a part of today's conversation. The show is live, and we're taking calls. We welcome your comments, your stories, your questions, and you can call us at 781-3875. Again, 781-3875. And so when we're talking about, you know, we're talking about something more than just sadness. You know, and although we all have sad days and sometimes really sad days, really disappointing days, what is it that parents should be alert to? And, you know, I mentioned ages. We're talking about 10-year-olds. We're talking about 11-year-olds. Mm-hmm. We're not just talking about moody teenagers.
And that's where it becomes hard, I believe, because they are teenagers mm-hmm. and they are going through the whole hormonal thing and hormonal changes. And so do you attribute that all of a sudden their moodiness or their anxiety or whatever change in behavior, oh, that's just hormones.
Right.
But maybe it's not.
Right.
So it's worth a discussion on any level of, hey, what's going on? What's going on at school? How are your friends? Are you stressed about classes? Let's really talk about this. And you need to really spend some time with your teenagers and get to know them.
Absolutely. How do we do that when it's nothing?
I know. Good.
How do we get there?
Well, in Youth Mental Health First Aid, we have that conversation. We take a look at adolescent development and what is a typical, and we tend to stay away from the word normal because I don't know if that really exists. So the typical adolescent behavior. And what you find is some of the symptoms of a mental health condition can be the same as typical adolescent behavior. Mm-hmm. Mood swings, isolation, reckless behavior, and so many teachers have asked, how do I know the difference? And parents will probably ask the same thing. And so what we look at is the impact that it's having on this young person's life. Are they able to continue in their school life and do the things that they've typically been able to do up until that point?
So if somebody was involved in athletics and now loses the energy for that?
Well, it's sometimes young people change interests, and okay. and yeah. but what you would see is that it's not replaced with anything else.
Okay,
mm-hmm. That could be an indicator that it could possibly might be okay. Depression, or you know. Pulling away from family to hang more out with friends, you know,
yes.
that's typical.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if they pull away from family and they isolate
and
from friends, you know, so you start to say, you know what, maybe I need to ask you, you know, how are you doing? How are you really doing? And use those I statements. I see that you're, you know, not going to practice anymore. And I'm worried about you. You know, you can talk about if that's something you want to do. So that's a way that a family can maybe look at, you know, because the parents, they know their child really well. You mm-hmm. know, they know when something's off.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Yes. Yeah. And you need to not overlook it and not throw it under the rug as if it's just normal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the parents don't have to take that role of clinician and feel like they have to diagnose either. You know, it's just you love them, you know, you recognize, and then you get the resources that they may need. Because sometimes the parents don't play that role in their child's life.
I agree with you. And the most important thing here is to get the resources out. There's as the parent of the child, I didn't know the resources that were available in the community at the time. And now I'm blown away. Not that it would have changed anything, mm-hmm. but it's like, wow, this is awesome. We have to get the word out of the resources. In this tiny little San Luis community, there's so many places you can turn.
Right. So. Christine, do you feel comfortable sharing what were some of the symptoms for your son?
Sure. He started using alcohol to suppress his anxiety and everything else like that at the age of 16. And we worked through that for a long time, or tried to work through that for a long time. He had severe depression. He had tics and stuff where he would pull his hair. So he had quite a lot of going on, and we just couldn't find the right fit to help him. And along with it is the mental health stigma. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want the stigma of the mental health. He wanted mm-hmm. it to be a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. How many times we went to the ER saying, mm-hmm. Mom, just give me an MRI. Just make them give me an MRI. Mm-hmm. And we would do it and it would come back normal. So it was that stigma of I can't have a mental illness. Mm-hmm. So those were the things that he really struggled with. And he actually did very well in school and well in athletics and his friends. But he pulled away from the family. So in the last year or two, he really pulled away from the family, and I couldn't reach back to him.
Yeah. And Frank, you know, what Christine was saying, I think is an important point, too. We think of suicide being completed after or being attempted after a severe depression, mm-hmm. but depression can also be acute anxiety as well.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, so one of the other populations that has made pretty good strides in this conversation is our college populations. Here locally, of course, we have two colleges right here in the county, and both have been impacted a great deal by suicide in the mm-hmm. last 5-10 years.
Yes.
I think more so than maybe we would have been paid attention to or understood 10 years ago. And part of that is we're starting to recognize some of the stressors and anxiety triggers that our young people are now being handed in very difficult situations. And some of that is academic. Some of that is adjusting to very different types of living environments. The pace at which, you know, I have two daughters at Cal Poly, the pace at which our young academics are moving now is far different than any of my peers, you know, experienced in school. So, in fact, we have a grant that has a therapist on campus at Cal Poly specifically to deal with first episode psychotic incidents.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, though, they are working with young people who have either an ideation or have made attempts around their own life. And that discussion is so real at the college level here too. So it's not always driven by, like I said, a long-rooted mental illness or
yeah.
something that is more clinical at the time. Sometimes it is driven by true anxiety and stress. I think the suicide prevention discussion, though, is that we don't really care. You know, we don't really care what got you to me. You're here now, you know, and I think back to your question about, you know, the young person who says, well, I don't want to talk about it. And I think you touched upon it perfectly, which is, it's the same answer I give, you know, years I've done drug and alcohol education, and parents who say, well, if he doesn't want to talk about it, the answer is, I love you. And I'm going to ask again tomorrow because I do love you. And there's always going to be a tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I'm always going to ask. And that's that, that reflection is the same with this topic as it is with, you know, if it was just, using air quotes here, you can't see in Radio Land, a substance use, you know, issues.
Right. Yeah. You, in one of the things I was fascinated about you too, Amy, is that you started a nonprofit that has to do with eating disorders and dance, correct?
Yes, I did.
And how does that fit in with some of this?
Well, having suffered an eating disorder for 18 years, part of my two of my mental illnesses, they kind of, I felt like at times played off of each other. The bipolar disorder and the bulimia went hand in hand. And there's actually statistics that show that eating disorders have a high incidence with other mental illnesses. And so when I got well from my eating disorder and I kind of broke free from that, I was, you know, determined to turn a new leaf and figure out what was that connection and how can we start that new conversation that eating disorders are very much prevalent in mental health, but we don't talk about them as much. Mm-hmm. And also for the dance community, they have the highest rate of eating disorders in our society. And so in my experience as a pre-professional classical ballet dancer, I suffered a severe spinal injury at the age of 17, and it ended my career. Mm-hmm. So that was a traumatic event that took place, and I also had some other things going on at the time with my family, and so it was almost, sometimes I describe it as a perfect storm. There was these overlapping things that happened, and that's what brought my mental health condition to the surface. Mm-hmm. When I was 16 years old was the first time I thought of suicide, because again, I was so traumatized by emotionally and mentally and physically from that injury, and I started showing signs of depression. I started showing signs of anxiety, and my family saw it, you know, and they did everything they could to support me. And but so the eating disorder is also the thing that sort of drove the, it kind of gave me this high pain tolerance for emotional pain, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
so what happens is when you have a really high emotional pain tolerance and you no longer fear death, suicide's just like, it's the next step. And so with eating disorder clients, it's really important to remember that, you know, they have they're not, you know, afraid to do things that might be destructive, because that's part of their disorder.
Mm-hmm. Or physical discomfort.
Right, because physical discomfort kind of goes along with the territory. Mm-hmm. So I think it was at the very end in 2010 when I was hospitalized for a suicide attempt. They told me that in the psych hospital that I needed to go inpatient for my eating disorder. And of course, my insurance said they wouldn't cover it. So I had to take another route to treatment. It was just one of my passions to get back to dance, to find a place where I could say, I understand the pressure that you're going through, and there's hope and there's healing and there's freedom out there.
And we're talking about eating disorders not only in females.
No,
we're talking about definitely in males too.
Yeah.
And is that another symptom, another sign that one?
Oh, it definitely could be.
One
yeah.
could see. What about, you know, because we're talking about the impervience to pain or the willingness to experience pain. What about cutting?
Yeah, so cutting is not always linked directly to suicide.
Right.
And so that is sometimes conflated in the public, you know, parents are certainly, oh my gosh, if that's
Should
what you're
concerned.
Doing, this is, you know.
Yeah, because they think that people cut because they want to end their life.
They want to end their
right.
life, which is not
the case. It's
not,
like a coping.
Typically it's a coping mechanism. It's a replacement. Some people drink, some
right.
people use other drugs.
I binge and purged to deal with my pain.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. And cutting is sometimes looked at, you know, at that too. It's not to say that a person who is self-harm is not willing to increase that harm and as a test. And unfortunately, suicide can also be accidental. And so that's, you know, that's a possibility there too. But clinically, I think a lot of what we see is young people who cut are typically not suicidal as much as they are masking something that, unfortunately, untreated could be very detrimental. Engaging that young person and their family and getting them the help that they need, as Chris said, there's lots of resources. That's the goal.
You're listening to KCBX, your public radio station, at 90.1 FM, San Luis Obispo, 91.7 FM, Salinas to Paso Robles, 89.5 FM, Santa Barbara, and on the web at kcbx.org. Statistics indicate that males comprise 84% of all completed suicides. Because males often chose more violent methods or attempts, they're more often successful, but females may attempt more suicides than males. And what may be reported as an accidental overdose may sometimes be uncounted suicides that would increase the numbers that we have reported, which is also a really important point to point out, especially with all of the opioid use that we've got right now, too. My guests with local knowledge around these issues and to discuss growing concerns about teens and suicides are here, and that's Amy Waddle, whose team is high school program trainer, Frank Warren, Division Manager of Prevention and Outreach at Slo County Behavioral Health, and Christine Claxton, volunteer with the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. And our phone lines are live, and you can bring your comments, questions, stories into our discussion on air by calling us at 781-3875. And we have a call from Louise. Louise, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome.
Hi. My question is there any help in the schools, or is the best way if you need some help to go directly to the county facilities?
It's a good question.
I think the goal is to get to the first person who you think can help you. And if that person is on your school campus, your school counselor, teachers, faculty, that's what we're working right now to be sure that all of our school faculty for at least middle school and high schools in this county have training around that first response, whether that first response is to refer you to a therapist or that first response is to refer you to another level of resource. But you're right. Any county behavioral health facility, which, you know, of course, are countywide, will accept any call anytime, as will Slo Hotline. I mean, I think the Hotline is a gift in our county that we should never, forget. That really is a great first step for a lot of individuals and their families is to make that call. And then that call will get that person moved to the appropriate level.
And that, you know, that hotline is open 24/7.
24/7, yeah.
And we do have in the high school program from Transitions Mental Health Association, we are now starting to implement putting a mental health advocate on campus once a week at the high schools and trying to add that, again, an extra resource for students and teachers, actually, who suspect that maybe a student is struggling with a mental health condition and they just need someone to check in with them. And so our goal is to have that in every school in this county so that we'll have a mental health worker on campus.
Is that for every... We lost Louise. Is that for every high school and middle school? Is that for every age? What's the goal here?
Yeah, so right now the state policy is that every middle school and high school, basically every grade over seventh grade, has to have a policy. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they have to have therapists on campus or a crisis team or any of that. It just means they have to have a plan, basically. Mm-hmm. What we're enjoying seeing is that our districts responded well. This just came out this year. It's for 17-18. Policies are being put into place. A lot of schools are looking at programs like TEMA is doing to bring extra resources on campus. We've trained I believe, 6 districts now in what's called More Than SAD, which is another curriculum based around response. QPR is next. Amy's a QPR trainer. That is another one we recommend a lot for schools to have leadership teams, school first responders on campus.
Yeah, because the peers have, they talk to each other.
That's
and
exactly
so
right.
Training the students to do the interventions with each other is, again, you know, getting the first person that's sitting in front of you, you know.
Yeah. So the when I first started talking today, one of the things that we're working on now is a suicide prevention coordinator position that will then be able to go work with the schools to be sure that not only the policies are written, that they're being adhered to, that they may need additional training put in them, a way of certificating when, you know, schools need to know whether their staff have been trained.
Right.
So that's coming next. That's kind of a next step that we're working on as well. But yes, the goal should be that in this county, at least, any and again, these the mandate only requires for public schools. So back to Louise's question, same thing with substance use. I always tell parents, like, call your school, ask them what resources are on campus.
Right.
Ask whether or not they are, how they're trained, what are the resources there. You may find out that there's nothing, but you may find out also that they have, for instance, at least 8 of our high schools have contracted therapists at least part of the week on campus, additional to their school staff.
Right.
Those are great resources. We have schools that actually have mental health programs built in within their school system. And a lot of times parents just don't know that the resource is there. Sadly, and I'm sure Amy's finding out working with schools, sometimes schools themselves don't know what they have. Because admin has a deal with a counselor over here, but the teacher that really has to respond to Johnny's need doesn't really know that.
Yeah.
And so those are the things that we're all kind of working together here to help connect all those dots.
Right. There are organizations. I know TEMA goes into schools. Community Counseling Center goes in.
Today on Sloak High Campus, they're having a mental health fair.
Yeah.
And all of the community providers who are working on the schools all get together, and they're all in the lunch area. And it was really inspiring. And the students are going around and collecting resources. And again, it's not every campus is there yet.
Right.
But we have found from the teachers' feedback that they want to know what they can do to help their students.
Right. Right.
And they're so thankful that they're getting these tools to be able to help, because, you know, again, they're pressed for time. But what can I say? If I see this, what do I do?
Right.
You know, so they're really thankful that there's somebody helping them.
Yeah.
Our students are there. I think that's an important thing to understand,
yes,
too.
Yes.
Our students in this county, and I would say probably, globally, are ready for this conversation. They are so accepting of the diversity of this conversation. And anyone who has a social media account should know this, that this is a generation of young people who are willing to call things what they are. They're willing to have that discussion. The stigma still exists that around mental illness, but mental health doesn't have stigma. And there's a difference there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that young people do want to be mentally healthy or brain healthy, as Amy said. They want to be well. I think they want to encourage each other to be well. And by doing so, they have to openly admit that there are sometimes when things get bleak and they don't feel well, or they are suicidal. So I think our young people are ready. I think we now need to move our systems and our organizations and institutions that way, too.
I think the other question, too, is when students know from their friends that they see somebody who is suicidal or who is in a period of real despair, what they can do about it, you know. And obviously your friends saw that you were in a real dark place. Did they engage you?
I remember it was back in 2010, and I was sitting at work, and I knew that if I went home, I was going to do something really dangerous. And I knew, you know, I wasn't going to be safe. And I had a friend sitting next to me, and she was the one that said, well, then don't you think the safest place for you would be the hospital? And it was just took that statement for me to be like, yeah, you're right, it would be. And it took a lot of courage for her to say that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
that's a good friend.
Yeah, because again, it's a scary place to admit yourself. But it kind of breaks down that stigma. And I thought for so many years that I was the only one involved in my pain. But looking back on it, you know, my family and my friends experienced this with me. Mm-hmm. And all the good, all the bad, but all the good too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and with suicide, we think that, you know, the person who's contemplating suicide really wants to die, when in fact, that's not the case. They want their pain
to go away. Well, it's not always associated with an ongoing deep depression either. There are those people that complete suicide because of an episodic situation.
Absolutely.
And impulse. Mm-hmm. Alcohol can be
Definitely. Just
that, you know, that thing that puts the impulse control at abeyance.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, my granddaughter's boyfriend completed suicide after they broke up. And it was in that moment, you know, that he was drinking. And
it's when all the pieces mm-hmm. come together and it's just a bad mess.
It's, as you said, the perfect storm. You know,
yeah.
And it's a horrible, horrible situation for someone to feel so at the end that nothing will get better. Mm-hmm. And they have no history of knowing that you can get through that.
And I think that's really nice that your friend reached out to you, because I think that is an important takeaway, is that if you see someone who looks like they're struggling, situational or long-term,
Right. Reach
out to them and just ask, how are you doing? What are you feeling? Ask those good questions, because you may be the only one who ever asks, mm-hmm. and you may be the one that said the right thing at the right time
Right. And
saved a life.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid to say it. And don't be afraid to say, are you suicidal? It's the word that I think we're so nervous to say, like, oh my gosh, if I say it, I'm going to plant that seed.
Right.
Or I'm going to give them that idea. And you're not. It's either there or it's not. And if you ask, either way, it's out in the open. And that's Right. Where it should be, in the open.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And it also says, I care.
Yes.
I want you here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I don't want you to go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Let's take a call here. Hi. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi.
Did you have a question or comment?
Oh, I have a question. My daughter, she's 16 and a half. She's been a straight-A student, but she's been expressing to me recently she has really high anxiety. And, of course, I've been trying to help her with that and ask her if she wants, you know, some therapy and, you know, been trying to really get her to open up. Last night she came home for the first time highly intoxicated from alcohol, and that's always been something she's been really aware of not participating in, but she came home very intoxicated with her arms cut last night, and she told me she thinks she's bipolar and depressed and just full of anxiety, and you know, but she doesn't want to, she's afraid to go seek the help outside of home because of the stigma. And so this is very fresh. I just turned on the radio and heard this. And so I'm in a state of not knowing what to do to help her right now. And so I heard the radio, I heard you guys on the radio, and I thought maybe you can lead me in some direction where I can get some help for her.
Well, first, I'm so glad you called in, and I can't think of a better panel of three people for you to call in and talk to.
Mm-hmm. So I'll just jump in from the county behavioral health perspective would be to have you call our 800 number. I'll get that number. I'll pull it up because I don't want to give you the wrong number. And all of a sudden, a million numbers are flashing through my brain right now.
Okay.
To call that, and that you'll get somebody on the line who will talk through with you some of these symptoms and some of the things that you've been experiencing. And then they're going to let you know whether or not they can, when they can bring you or your daughter in, or whether there's a more immediate resource for you that may be, you know, better suited depending on the issue. So that's the first thing I would recommend. The second thing is that you don't let up and you continue to, seek those resources. So if your daughter is on a school campus, again, like I said before, call the school campus and find out whether there's, sometimes that resource is more immediate because she's at school. And that might mean, you know, reducing some of that wait time. Again, slow hotline is another call that can be made where they can help, you know, kind of give you some options from there. But you are well within, you know, you're exactly right to be asking that question and making that phone call. And then keep working with your daughter on encouraging her that this is this is for all of you, and this is, you know, for health for all of you. That it's not a nothing to be ashamed about whatsoever. That all of us struggle and all of us hurt, and we all should ask for help because it's there.
Yeah.
Let me get that number here.
Okay. Thank you. I would love that number.
And did you want to say something, Amy?
Well, I got to say how proud I am that that you had the courage to call and reach out, because, you know, so many suffer in silence and just kind of don't know what to do. And to really step out is you know, and your love for your daughter is definitely what's going to get you both through all of this. You know, and like using the resources that Frank mentioned you know, and just, you know, keeping connected, and sometimes you may have to feel like you're being a little bit pushy, you know, you know, persuading her that, you know, I need you here. I want you here. You have value, and whatever that's going on right now, it might not last forever. I might not be this way tomorrow. And how, you know, and again, making her feel like this is an us thing and not, you know, we'll fix you or we're going to help you, but maybe that we're going to figure this out, and we will do everything we can to support you, whatever that looks like.
Okay. Do you have something to write this number down?
I do, yes.
Okay.
So the Behavioral Health All Access line is 800 838 1381.
Oh, okay. I've recognized this number. Is that part of the Holman group?
So what will happen? So the Holman, that's a great question. Now this is a whole nother
hour-long topic. You know what Holman group is.
But the Holman group is a group of Medi-Cal, not Medi-Cal, but other private insurance providers.
Yes.
And so sometimes if you call the 800 number, they may refer you to the Holman group, who then will tell you who the resources are are not county resources. So a lot of it just has to do with insurance.
They helped me when my daughter was going through, she had an eating disorder years ago. Probably never goes away, anorexia.
Uh-huh.
She controls her food intake. And so I used the Holman group to get resources for myself and for her when she was going through that. So that's why I recognize the phone number.
Yeah, so that's the main line for the county, who may, like I said, may refer you or patch you into the Holman group. The other number is you should write down is SLO hotline.
Okay, I'm ready for that.
And that's also an 800 number.
Okay.
And it's 783-0607.
Okay. Great. And I guess the biggest question is when she just wants the help from me. She doesn't want to find outside help or start diving into that. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling her that I'm not a professional. I can only give her my love and support, but I can't give her professional advice, and that's where she's really struggling with that.
And with the history of the anorexia, I think you just make sure that when you do make the call for resources that you mentioned that, you know, she has had that in the past, and do you know if she's actively struggling with that?
She's not. No,
okay.
I'm very aware. It hasn't.
Okay,
she hasn't been
good.
Struggling with that for the last. She was in boarding school last year, and they had a regular eating, you know, they all sat down and had regular meals, and she really was able to get herself back on track, and now she's back at home, and she's been, I haven't noticed anything.
Okay.
There's
a great resource for, it's actually a website called Ed Referral, like Ed is E-D.
Uh-huh.
.com, and it is the biggest eating disorder resource website out there, and they have, you search your area and they will pull up all of the providers, whether it be psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, support groups. And, you
that
know,
it's very hard to find.
It is. Yeah.
When I was looking for referrals for therapists and for groups, like, you know, just meetings for teenagers that have eating disorders, I had a really hard time with that when I was searching in this county, in San Luis Obispo County.
Yes, we do have a treatment center here in the county, Central Coast Treatment Center, and they do I think it's called intensive outpatient, and they have partial hospitalization, and they also have evening support groups. So they would be a great resource. Good. Central Coast Treatment Center. They're right in downtown San Luis.
Central Coast Treatment. Okay.
Good luck with all of that.
Everybody.
Yeah. Good job, Mom.
Okay. Good job, Mom.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Okay. Bye bye.
So we have about 10 minutes left in today's show. We could probably take about one more call. If someone wants to call in at 781-3875. But I want to make sure that we're hitting points that you three want to get across today. So, Frank, I'm going to start with you. Important things that you want to make sure that we don't leave out today.
Well, I think I would recap, as I think we've hit some really, really, I think we jumped right away into the importance of, one, the dialogue, and that the community should be completely free to openly talk about suicide. We should talk about the risk. We should talk about the help. We should talk about our survivor stories and the stories that maybe people have not wanted to share because they didn't think it might help somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, a realization for me was, you know, I had experienced it with friends, but I hadn't really thought of it as, I didn't calculate how much of an impact it had on my life. Maybe I could help somebody who's struggling with a friend who they don't really know how to, you know, how to help. So I think we all are impacted by suicide. Mm-hmm. I think we should openly talk about that, and it's okay. Right. So I think that's my first big takeaway. The second is that we need to look at our organizations and our systems where there's risk, and we need to make sure that they have the support that they need to address that risk. And so if that's schools, we need to encourage our schools to open their doors to the discussion of mental health and wellness and suicide prevention and eating disorders and substance use disorders, things that our young people struggle with. Our schools should be first responders, and they should be welcome to, because they can't do it all, they should be welcoming help from the community in order to do that, because that's where our young people are. And the third piece is back to this call, you know, both calls today. You'll never be wrong asking for help. You'll never, and I'm really proud of this community for that reason. You know, there was a time where if you called the wrong number, right, because, you know, you had a an issue with the color green and it wasn't the color red and you called the red building, they would say, well, you know, you got to call the color green building.
Right.
And that was very, that was the bad times for us in our county. And that wasn't that long ago. But now, pretty much any one of these numbers that we give you, you make that call, someone's going to know where your most available and close resource is. And so making the call, asking for help. Even if it is looking at your workmate or your roommate and saying, I need something, we're getting better at that response.
Yeah.
And if you don't feel out there, if you don't feel like you're ready to give that response, seek training. Contact us. Let us know how we can help. Transitions Mental Health Association, AFSP, the county. We're all putting on training to help first responders.
And this is training not only for professionals, but
that's
training
right,
for lay people.
That's
this
because
is
they're
people.
Yeah.
People, the CPR training, all of that is not just for professionals.
Right. No, we are all. We all have the ability to prevent suicide.
Exactly.
And it's a community issue.
And to understand how to intervene, how to have that conversation,
yeah.
You know, and how to not feel awkward.
Yeah, yes. Amy's brought up her dance, you know, program. For years, I was out trying to get coaches and dance instructors and scout leaders and, you know, the people who are with our young people when they're not in school, next. You know, who's that next level, the 3 o'clock level?
Right.
Because so many times we hear that it was the coach who was the first person that got told, and I'll just use coach globally for that after-school, right, you know, grouping. We need to be sure that as parents, we need to ask the question, you know, would you know what to do if my kid really had, right, an issue that they were willing to give to you but not to me? And it's okay. We should get trained.
Yeah, great. I'm going to take a real quick call from Nicole here. Nicole.
Yeah.
I've got just a couple of minutes, Nicole. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I do have a question. I have a 12-year-old daughter who is suffering from severe, she's attempted to commit suicide 3 times now, and she's a 7th grader. We've been dealing with this for about the last 2 months, and she currently is at a residential treatment program right now in Whittier, California, because we do not have a residential treatment program around here. And so what I'm looking for is when she gets back from her treatment program, if there is any, like, group or what is available for somebody who does not have public insurance. We have private insurance, and we are trying to find group therapy or different types of therapy besides just the counseling, like one-on-one counseling and psychiatry. I've also found an art hypnotherapist, and we are, she is participating in that when she does come home. But we are looking for, like, group therapy, and I was wondering if there's anything that you guys are aware of for a child as old as 12 years old.
So in the private insurance world, that's going to be, certain therapists are going to offer it, and it's not really a well, unfortunately, we don't really have like a clearinghouse of information where we can tell you which therapists do groups or not. The best thing to do is call the therapist who you feel most comfortable with, you know, contact the county if you need for a referral, and they will let you know because it's there, you know. You could look at CAMFT, which is the Marriage and Family Therapist Organization, CAMFT. That will also give you a listing. Typically, when you see the listings, they'll let you know whether that a provider does group work, and so you may be able to do that just kind of using, you know, let your fingers do the walking on the interwebs, but otherwise it's very difficult. But I would also reach out to Amy will jump in here with Transitions Mental Health Association, who do have ongoing groups for peers. Amy, if there's something
I know that when I, as a mental health advocate, I am always looking for resources, and the one place that I've been able to go for credible resources is psychology. I think it's psychologytoday.com, and all of their therapists are certain, you know, they kind of go through checks, and then you can go through a filter where you go to who works with adolescents, filter it even further, what is their modality and their approach, and you can filter it further if they offer group therapy. And that is, we've found a lot of trusted therapists that way for and group workers, so that way, so that might be something you could do.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Well, thank you guys for your suggestions. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, good luck.
Good luck, sure, Nicole.
Thanks. Thank you.
Bye. Well, I want to thank all three of you for being here today. Last words from you, Christine?
Is really, don't hesitate to ask and have that conversation. That's the most important thing. And ask your schools what kind of resources they have. Start that conversation, because they are now required to have some sort of program. So see what they're thinking. I know it's new this year, but see what they're thinking. And get out there.
And 30 seconds, Amy?
30 seconds for me. There's also a crisis text line, which I don't even have the number, so that's like awesome of me, right?
Okay, but give the hotline number again.
So that a lot of people just, they feel more comfortable texting. So that's another resource.
Here's your crisis hotline.
Crisis text talk to 741-741. And also just adopting the idea, you know, these are our youth. These are our kids. And so together we can make a difference for everybody.
I want to thank my guests for today's show, Amy Waddle, TEMA's high school program trainer, Frank Warren, Division Manager of Prevention of Outreach in San Luis Obispo County Behavioral Health, and Christine Claxton, volunteer with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Next week, we'll be joining other NPR member stations as part of a series called You, Me, and Them, Experiencing Discrimination in America. The program will be rooted in a large national poll by NPR in collaboration with the Robert Wood Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. It's a unique survey of more than 3,400 residents, asked people about their personal experiences with discrimination across the range of areas of life. Central Coast Voices will be joining that conversation with a local perspective, and that will include Fred Monroe, Courtney Haley, Renanda Campbell, and Dr. Michael Latner. Thank you for joining us on Central Coast Voices.